Most worshipful Grand Master, Grand Lodge officers, distinguished guests, and my brothers all. Before I begin my talk this morning, I want to read to you an email that I received just yesterday from a brother in Massachusetts because it's relevant to the subject that I will speak on this morning. He writes to me, evidently I had one of my papers was published in the last issue of the Knight Templar magazine. I haven't seen it yet. It must have been released while I was here in Montana, but I received 8 or 9 emails so far in response to it from 8 or 9 jurisdictions. But this one I looked at last evening, and I want to read it to you. Dear Sir Knight Jackson, thank you so much for your article, Crafting the Mason, in the July 2009 issue of the Knight Templar magazine. Although my grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather were Masons, as soon as I became a Mason some 20 years ago, I have often wondered why I joined an organization that was really only good for making friends and donating money to charities. I thought that surely once there was more to Masonry than that, and occasionally I noticed another Mason who felt a similar lack in Masonry. Feeling as I do, is it no wonder why I never encouraged another man to become a Mason? Is it no wonder that Masonic organizations in my state find it difficult to increase their membership? Although it is still in some of our ritual, Masons in my state are not even encouraged to assist brothers before non-brothers. Apparently, to non-Masons, we are just another charitable organization. The Grand Master asked me if I would be willing to attend this Grand Lodge communication and to speak to you concerning my views and observations on Freemasonry. And my brothers, it's a great privilege for me to do so. I do want to clarify, before I begin, however, my perceived position and purpose in our craft. I have been introduced over the years in a number of categories, including as a Masonic scholar, author, orator, and historian. I was even introduced to the President of Portugal as a noted Masonic philosopher. I thought about this introduction for a long time, wondering why anyone would refer to me as a philosopher. Then I began to comprehend that a philosopher was one who has developed opinions, and I certainly have been known over the years for my opinions, so perhaps I'm as close to being a Masonic philosopher as any of the other categories. On one occasion, when visiting a New Jersey lodge to speak, a brother greeted me by stating that he realized that I was controversial, but that I was welcome in New Jersey. And my brothers, I have no problem being controversial. I realize that I have probably been one of the most outspoken critics of North American Freemasonry over the last 25 years, relative to the direction it is going and the methods used to alter the course. A few of you here know that I live on a small farm in South Central Pennsylvania with a stream bordering the farm. A friend of mine across the stream raises prime Holstein cows, and he kept several bulls in the farm to service the cows, a big bull, a medium-sized bull, and a little bull. Those who understand the pecking order of animals recognize that the big bull got most of the cows. The medium-sized bull only had a few, and the little bull only had one. And my friend decided one time that he was going to improve the milk production of the herd, and he would bring in a grand champion bull. And again, for those of you who may not understand, although I would suspect all of you out here in the West would, that the milk-producing capacity of the resulting cows through breeding is a result of the quality of the bull. When word got around the barnyard that he was going to bring in a grand champion bull, the three bulls got together to discuss it. The big bull said, "There probably goes some of my cows." And the medium-sized bull said, "Yeah, there probably goes most of mine." And without the little bull said, "Well, I sure hope he lets me keep my one." When the day came for the grand champion bull to be delivered, the three bulls were standing up in a hill overlooking the barnyard. The cattle truck backed in, the ramp came down, and this massive big bull come lumbering down off that truck. With that, the big bull said, "Oh my God, there goes all my cows." The medium-sized bull said, "Oh, there sure went all of mine." And with that, the little bull started to pant, snort, and slobber, and paw the ground. The other two bulls looked at him and said, "What's wrong with you? Are you out of your mind? What do you think you're doing, challenging that great big bull?" And the little bull said, "Challenge him, challenge him. Hell, I'm just making sure he knows I'm not a cow." I use that little story as an analogy to cause you to realize that I am not the cow either. It is significant to know what one is not, and I have never looked at myself as fitting into any one of the categories by which I have been introduced. One of the primary reasons that Freemasonry became as great as it did is because it attracted some of the greatest minds that ever lived. Consider for a moment how many great men comprised early Freemasonry and as a result stimulated other great men to want to become part of it. Consider men like Washington, Franklin, Revere, Voltaire, Amadeus Mozart, Sir Christopher Wren, Simon Bolivar, Giuseppe Garibaldi, Joseph Priestley, and we could go on and on listing literally hundreds of others who have contributed to making this world what it is today. They also, however, contributed to making Freemasonry what it is today in most of the world. Realistically, however, I realize that I am and have always been and will always be just a little country boy who developed a great appreciation for this craft. I realize that no matter how important I may ever think I am to this world, I will never serve as an example to stimulate great men to want to become a Freemason. I perceive my purpose in the craft as being to do all that I can to preserve it until great minds come along again to inspire it. Chief Renami Abba wrote in his book, Light After Darkness, quote, "Even if my thoughts and ideas may be controversial or in certain respects open to question, I shall have succeeded in my attempt if these ideas have generated further thoughts on the main substance of Freemasonry in the search for universal truth." Unquote. And so mote it be with me. It is always my goal when I speak to challenge you to think. For if I fail to do that, I waste both your time and mine. So today it is my goal to cause you to think, to hopefully stimulate you to learn a little bit more about this noble institution, and to cause you to, as the Grand Master expects, introspectively examine what each of you can do to benefit Freemasonry. I have been extremely fortunate over the last 20 or more years to be able to travel the world as a Freemason and to experience Freemasonry as it operates outside of America. In these travels, I have been able to observe Freemasonry in many foreign countries and compare it to the Freemasonry of America. I have been able to see where it works well and where it continues to increase in membership, where it continues to attract some of the greatest men in their jurisdictions, indeed where it remains an organization whose members are the movers and shakers of society. I have experienced new grand lodges being consecrated and extinct or suppressed ones being reconsecrated following the fall of dictatorial regimes. I have watched Freemasonry rising on the continent of Africa and its members occupying some of their country's dominant positions. Indeed, two of the presidents of African countries are also the Grand Masters of their Grand Lodges. At the same time, I have watched the struggles of these new Grand Lodge officers in trying to cope with the challenges of operating an organization that promotes freedom and equality of men in environments where freedom and equality was unknown for decades, and where individuals struggled to achieve success was at best a muted phenomenon. I have become familiar with the requirements of foreign grand jurisdictions for a man to gain membership and to remain as a member of our craft, both of which are far more stringent than anything we have ever known in North America. I have become more consciously aware of the universality in Masonic philosophy and precept that dominates Freemasonry globally, while at the same time observing definitive differences in the operating philosophies in different sociological environments. I will emphasize some of these observations that I have made in various areas of the world regarding the evolution of Freemasonry and the resulting differences that characterizes the craft in those areas, along with my opinions as to why Freemasonry is declining in North America while it is thriving in many other parts of the world. I will also relate to you some of my personal experiences demonstrating the significance of our fraternity in other parts of the world. None of us, my brothers, can be unaware of the decreasing interest in our craft and decline in influence that North American Freemasonry has experienced over the last 50 years, and especially over the last 25. One of the first addresses that I ever gave over 35 years ago dealt with my observations of the decrease in the quantity of our membership. Excuse me. North American membership has gone from over 4 million to approximately 1.5 million today. It does not take much thought to be recognized that Freemasonry's future in North America is bleak. If we continue the loss of membership, at least Freemasonry as it is historically known. I have, however, in more recent years, been far more concerned with the decreasing quality of the membership than with the quantity of the membership. The decrease in the quality is a major contributing factor to the decrease in the quantity today. Every person likes to be affiliated with a quality organization. If quantity is lost, quantity can be regained. But if quality is lost, it may be lost forever. Freemasonry in North America has been losing its attractive force for quality professional men for the last 25 or 30 years. This is not the case in almost every foreign Masonic jurisdiction. One of the most impressive observations that I have made in my travels is in the quality of the brothers that I meet throughout the world. Let me give you just three quick examples of what I mean. 2 years ago, I was sitting at a banquet in Bucharest, Romania, next to a brother that I talked with during the dinner, and before I left, he handed me his card, told me if I ever come back to Romania to get in touch with him. I looked at his card, and he was the Romanian astronaut that flew with the Russians in their space program. Last year, I was sitting in Rome, Italy, next to a brother, and I mentioned to him that he had spoke very excellent English, and he said to me, well, I was educated in your country. I asked him where, and he said at Harvard. He said he still had a good friend of his that comes over each year to visit with him, Tony Scalera. Well, Tony Scalera is a Supreme Court justice. So I asked him, I said, do you still practice law? He said, no, I'm the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Italy. And next week, I have a brother flying in from Italy to spend a couple of days with me, who is the head of the Italian Space Agency, who I met in Rimini, Italy last year. My brothers, wouldn't it be great to be able to sit alongside in our lodges and our banquets with men like that in America? But keep in mind, to them and to us, they are nothing but brothers. In my studies of the craft, I have found that the philosophical purpose of Freemasonry is universal and unalterable, but the operational philosophies are dependent upon the environment in which it exists. Freemasonry has been driven to evolve into a form that fits most comfortably into the environment in which it must operate. The only exception that I have found of the society driving the environment was in early Russia, where instead of the society driving Freemasonry drove the society. This was prior to Catherine the Great closing down the craft. For the last 15 years, I have been attempting to classify variations in characteristics and place Freemasonry into what I refer to as styles. As a result, I have, to the present time, found four specific styles and probably five. European Freemasonry has retained much of the basic philosophy and intellectualism that characterized early Freemasonry. There is a continued emphasis on the acquisition of knowledge and programs to stimulate thought. European Freemasonry has not been forced to diverge from its roots by societal pressures that have been found in some other areas of the world. I put European Freemasonry into what I refer to as a philosophical style. I had for a long time placed English, Scottish, and Irish Freemasonry in the same philosophical style, although recently I am tending to place that Freemasonry into what I refer to as a social style. Although similar to the philosophical and intellectual style, they have retained much more of the social relationships that tended to characterize early Freemasonry in the British Isles. South and Central America, although retaining much of the philosophical and intellectual style of Europe, have evolved into a more unique style stimulated by the sociological pressures of the environment. I find it to be more idealistic and perhaps even more intellectually challenging than in the philosophical style. It also tends to establish goals that are much more difficult to attain. I refer to this style of Freemasonry as a sociological style because it is impacted more stringently by the sociology of the environment. Mexican Freemasonry, although existing in an environment not totally dissimilar than that of South and Central America, has a tendency to become more directly involved with the political climate in which it exists. For that reason, I have placed it into a style all of its own, which I refer to as a political style for the lack of a better term. There is no doubt that Freemasonry will continue to evolve. And although I have traveled for Freemasonry in the Far East and Africa, I have yet to differentiate a specific style. It would be interesting, however, to look back 50 years from now and observe their style of the craft and its impact on the development of their societies. North America, excluding Mexico and perhaps Canada, has developed a style unlike that of any other. It is a style that evolved into being to its greatest extent over the last 25 years. In that span of time, we have surrendered most of the intellectual and philosophical qualities of the craft, eliminating the stimulus to learn and excised the requirements to do so. We have directed most of our energies toward becoming an organization dedicated to raising money for outside charities. Hence, I refer to North American Freemasonry as a charitable style of the craft. Tragically, the result has been an erosion of our image in society. And ironically, we evolved into this approach in an attempt to buy back the respect and admiration along with that image that we are losing. As a result, we have surrendered the qualities of Freemasonry that made it such a unique entity. There are hundreds of organizations dedicated to specific charitable objectives, but there are precious few that were dedicated to improving the man, and this constituted much of the uniqueness of Freemasonry. Our uniqueness is what made the craft into what it is, probably the most outstanding and significant organization ever created by the mind of man. And in turn, Freemasonry made this world what it is today. It made it by taking the best man it could find and improving that man. By doing so, it changed the direction of civil society. Freemasonry was one of the primary enclaves that provided the environment during the Age of the Enlightenment that attracted great minds and laid the framework for a democratic society. The United States of America is one of the results. The more I study this craft, the more impressed I become with how much its presence meant to the development of civilization. And now I look with great sadness to the loss of both quantity and quality in North American Freemasonry. I look at the results of our early leadership and their magnanimous long-range vision that produced what we have inherited, and then observe not only the lack of that vision today, but even of understanding our significance in this world. The vast majority of our Grand Lodges have not produced a major program over the last 25 years, other than programs designed to increase numbers or to raise monies to give away to charities, both of which have been detrimental to us. And my friends, that is not the purpose of Freemasonry. I emphasized to the Grand Lodge of Russia several years ago while speaking in Moscow that we did not make this world by rolling over it with vast numbers. We made this world by making good men better, one man at a time. Unfortunately for Freemasonry, We live in a country that is a great equalizer. In the name of political correctness today, we have developed an attitude that everyone deserves the same as everyone else, regardless of our ability, desire, initiative, or work ethic. Yeah. As a result, the stimulus to rise above the level of mediocrity has been diminished in our society, and my brother's Freemasonry has bought into it. We refuse to raise initiation fees and dues because we feel that the average American could not afford it. The same average American who would spend at least an equal amount on something to smoke or drink or on entertainment and not give it a second thought. My brothers, it's not a matter of cost, it's a matter of priority. We in North America have absolutely no concept of what it means to be a Freemason in the rest of the world. The financial cost to affiliate with this organization in most of the world is in the thousands of dollars. And the time requirement to become a Master Mason is measured in years, not in months, let alone days. While we in North America are lessening our requirements to be Freemasons, much of the world is increasing theirs, or at least not decreasing them. I was in Brazil about 10 years ago, and I asked what the dues were in their jurisdiction, and they told me $50. When I expressed my surprise that their annual dues were that cheap, they told me it was $50 a month, not $50 a year. And there are some jurisdictions where the dues will run several thousand dollars a year. Several months ago, I asked a Scottish Freemason what the cost was for his initiation into his lodge and his annual dues. He told me that he paid £3,000 to join, and the dues were £1,000 a year. Keep in mind, my brothers, that the British pound at that time was almost double the American dollar. I was speaking at a symposium in Argentina about 8 years ago, and following a lodge meeting, we retired downstairs for the customary toasts, then went to a restaurant for dinner. Following dinner, the Grand Master spoke and the floor was open for discussion. About 3 o'clock in the morning, they finally took me back to my hotel, and after they dropped me off, they were walking across the street, and I asked them where they were going now. They told me they were stopping for a drink and then to continue their discussion. The next day, I asked the Grand Treasurer how late their meetings generally ran, and he told me that sometimes they didn't get home until it's time to go to work the next morning. Can you imagine how that would fly in this country? I also found that after receiving a petition, the lodge will conduct an investigation for the period of 1 year before bringing it up to ballot. And if approved, the first degree is conferred. Prior to receiving the second degree, the initiate will have, over a period of a year, presented at least 3 learned papers on Freemasonry. If he passes, he may, and then be questioned on the floor. If he passes, he may receive the second degree when the same process will take place prior to receiving the third degree. In many parts of the world, it takes a period of 1.5 to 3 years or more to receive the 3 degrees. Indeed, I was talking to a brother recently, and I can't recall for sure what Grand Lodge it was, but he told me that it took him 9 years to complete his 3 degrees. At this stage, my brothers, they know more about the craft than our members know in a lifetime of Freemasonry in North America. In addition, attendance at meetings in many jurisdictions is not an option, it's a requirement. A dozen years ago, when I was attending the Second World Conference in Portugal, a Portuguese brother told me that their lodge met every week. 3 of those meetings a month were for the purpose of Masonic education, and 1 for the purpose of conferring ritual and conducting business. The average age of the Portuguese Freemason at that time was approximately 29 years. Their Grand Lodge session that day was delayed for almost an hour so that they could expand the size of the room at the hotel to seat all the brothers attending. When at the Grand Lodge of Iceland several years ago, I learned that they had a 6-year waiting list just to get into a lodge. The National Grand Lodge of France rejects approximately 60% of every petition received, and their membership has increased an average of 10% a year for the past 12 years. The rate of rejection in almost every jurisdiction in the world far exceeds anything that we know in North America. And most of these Grand Lodges are increasing in membership while facing far greater challenges to their existence than we have ever known. Keep in mind that tens of thousands of Freemasons have been put to death over the years simply because they were Freemasons, and we in this country have not even known restraint. Unfortunately, in North America, and again in light of political correctness, we have determined that elitism is a dirty word. And yet when Freemasonry stated that their goal was to take good men and make them better, we became elitist. And my friends, there is nothing wrong with elitism. Elitism played a major role in bringing together the great minds in the age of the Enlightenment. It was these men with the great minds and capable of great thoughts that made it the influential segment of society that it became. Remember, my friends, fine porcelain cannot be made from bad clay. There is no question but the quality will attract quality. And if we wish to be a quality organization, then we must have quality members to attract quality members. I do not mean by this observation that there is no place in Freemasonry for the average man. Indeed, a second reason Freemasonry became as great as it has is because that it was also able to take men from all classes, occupations, and social structures and place them in lodge rooms as equals. The third major reason that caused Freemasonry to excel beyond all other organizations, however, was that it remained selective on the quality of the man that it would accept. My brothers, this is perhaps the major reason difference that I have found in most other jurisdictions. We in North America have become willing to accept almost anyone in a failing attempt to increase our numbers. As a result, the public now sees a different image of Freemasonry, and society will always judge you on your worst, never on your best. Yet we must be realistic. It is doubtful that any of us would ever serve as a major attracting force for those like the great men that I cited earlier, but we can serve as an example to stimulate quality men to want to become part of us. How many of you sitting here today were inspired to petition this craft because of men whom you knew, who set an example to you, and who were Freemasons? I was. We also must realistically recognize that our greatest hope for leadership must come from the professional environment, for they are the men with the training to be leaders before they became Freemasons. Now, we may argue all we want that these foreign jurisdictions that I have referred to have too stringent requirements and costs and demands for America, but I guess it all boils down to what we want to be. Do we want to be an organization with the capability of impacting the ongoing evolution of our society and being highly respected and admired, or do we want to be a dying organization of little note? Let me take just a few minutes and give you some examples of what I've experienced in my travels over the last 20 years. The first time I went to Greece, I had a brother who drove me to wherever I wanted to go. He would not even let me open the car door myself, insisting that he open the door for me. Just before I left Greece, someone told me that he was regarded as the greatest surgeon in Greece, and yet he was insisting on waiting on me. At the final banquet in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, an older brother came to me and told me that if I ever came back to that area of Africa, I never again stay in a hotel. He told me that he had a large home, his children were all gone, and he would be honored to have me stay with him, and that his home was my home. When he walked away, a brother asked me if I knew who he was, and I said no, and he told me that he was the ambassador of the United Nations. At the Second World Conference in Sao Paulo, Brazil, a young man was assigned to me to look after me for 9 days, taking care of all my needs. He sat behind me at every meeting in case I needed anything. He drove me wherever I wanted to go and insisted on providing for my every want. I found out the day before leaving Brazil that he was a pulmonary surgeon and professor of pulmonary medicine at the University of Sao Paulo. I had been on speaking agendas with the president of Chile and had lunch seated to his right at the presidential palace. I had been received by both the president and the prime minister's palace in Portugal. I was invited to hunt with the prime minister of Romania. I participated in laying a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier under the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, along with the presidents of Gabon and the Congo. I had met with members of royal families in Europe and had several dinners just this last week, 2 weeks ago, with the Princess of Yugoslavia, who is the first cousin to Queen Elizabeth. I was made a chief of a village of Negusef in the Ivory Coast. I had dinner at the home of the commanding general of the Gabon military and attended a beach party at a retreat of the Minister of Defense. I participated in the dedication of a Masonic monument in Valparaiso, Chile, where the monuments of all the great Chilean heroes are erected. This, my brothers, would be tantamount to us dedicating a Masonic monument on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Can you imagine that happening in this country today? These are just a few of the fascinating experiences that I have been privileged to participate in as a result of my affiliation with Freemasonry. It is extremely important, however, that you understand that none of this was for me. It was because of what I represented to Freemasonry and what Freemasonry represented in their countries. And by the way, the President of Chile and the President and Prime Minister of Portugal are not Freemasons. It would be extremely prudent for the leaders of our craft in America to take a serious look at those grand jurisdictions that are experiencing the greatest success and begin to consider the logic in trying to emulate their blueprint for succeeding instead of beating the same dead horse. We must stop playing the numbers game and begin and trying to buy back respect and through charitable org contributions, and begin to realize that by improving the quality of the craft, we will improve the quantity of the craft and regain that respect. We as individual members must set a positive example as to what this craft means to society. We are the living examples of what Freemasonry is. As a result of the recent publicity that we have received through Dan Brown's books and a couple of movies and television programs, Freemasonry is being given an opportunity of resurrection of significance in today's society. Young men are knocking at the door of Freemasonry, seeking to pass through the portals of an organization dedicated to priorities of improving the man and challenging the mind. They are seeking something the society is not offering, and now we must be willing and able to satisfy their quest. We may never again be given this opportunity. The question is, are we willing and are we able? The world deserves a positive answer, as do our predecessors, in this, the greatest organization ever conceived by the mind of man. My brothers, I thank you so much for having me with you today.